This is Deanne Lagerquist. I spend summers at Holden Village. This is the fourth summer that I've been here for the whole summer, the fifth summer in the row I have been here. And when I'm here, I do various things, from helping in registration to checking books in and out, just kind of what's needed. That's what makes Holden work, is that people pitch in and do what's needed. When I'm not at Holden Village, when I'm home in Minnesota, I teach religion at St. Olaf College. And so this week, what's needed is one more person on the teaching staff, and I'm delighted to kind of jumpstart the school year and remember that this is something that I do. The topic that I have announced for today, Feminist Christianity, an Oxymoron? Is a title that I've given to a course I'm going to teach in January. It's still developing in my mind what all is going to go on in the course. Certainly, I'm not going to try to do 4 weeks worth of material in 1 hour. More what I'm going to do is just set out the issue that we'll be investigating in January. My interest in this topic comes from several different roots, but the reason I've stated it the way that I have today is that there is a debate about the relationship between feminism and Christianity. And we're going to talk today about, first of all, some definitions of feminism and Christianity, and then about some possible relationships between the two. Obviously, I must think that it's not totally an oxymoron, because if it were, there would be no point in talking about it, right? But there are people who seem to think that it is an oxymoron, that is to say, that the two words are mutually exclusive, right? That you can't have both. So let's start out with something I often do in class. Before we define something, let's name some things that you think fit in these categories, okay? If we had two big baskets, one labeled Christianity and one labeled feminism, what are some of the things that you'd put in each of those? Let's start with feminism. These can be people, ideas, events.
Equality.
Empowerment.
Anything else?
Struggle.
Now, these don't have to be things that you maybe even necessarily agree with, but they could be characters of either one.
Okay. Anti-patriarchy.
Okay. People you would associate with feminism?
Hillary Clinton.
Okay. Others?
Clara Barton.
Gloria Steinem.
Are you looking for names or characteristics or what?
Anything.
Justice.
Justice. How about some of the wild things people say about feminism?
Pushy women. Okay.
Sometimes I do an exercise in class when I want synonyms for woman. And it's so interesting. Students, I know that they know a lot of really impolite words, but they'll never say them. Say, come on, say something nasty.
Bitch.
Yeah. Sometimes we associate that with them.
Man haters.
Emasculators.
Okay, now we got some nasties. Now, what about Christianity?
You left out frustrated broads.
Oh, okay. Okay, how about Christianity? What are some of the things you would have said?
Equality, empowerment.
Okay, so you think some of those are...
Empowerment.
Okay.
You bet.
Struggle.
Struggle, positive struggle. Okay.
Choices.
Oh, you guys, then we're not going to have anything to talk about.
I think patriarchy.
You think patriarchy?
Yeah, I was going to say that too. Okay. Patriarchy. So we can get something.
No, that's Christendom. That's not Christianity.
Well, we're not going to be real subtle here. We're going for the broad strokes at this point. Witness.
Grace.
Grace.
Truth. Life.
Life.
Love.
Love. I don't know why I'm writing these sideways.
Forgiveness.
Okay.
How about hierarchy?
Redemption.
Charity.
Promise.
Hope. Enough? You don't have any nasty ones here? We have a couple, but...
Five.
Legalistic.
Mm-hmm.
Narrow.
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 The way these are on the board has nothing to do with my view. I'm just... Excuse me? Did I hear some more? No.
Constraining.
Disembodied.
Okay, we got a nice full column there. Now, when you take these columns, one of the things that I think is immediately apparent is that both of these baskets are full of diverse things, right? But if we want to make a definition of either feminism or of Christianity, our definition needs to be expansive. Okay. Needs to be large and flexible. I'd like to suggest a definition for feminism, which is a descriptive definition rather than an assertion of what I as a feminist believe, although these aren't contradictory. I would say feminism is a cluster of ideas which have in common a negative assertion. And here, this is the negative assertion. Women are no less important than men. Okay? Women are no less important than men. There are within feminism many camps, many different views, but I think all of them could agree on that assertion. Women are no less important than men. Now, within these camps, there will be variations on that theme, okay? All the way from women are no less important than men because women are better than men, right? And we've had that variation in several different forms. In the 19th century, many of the moral reform movements thought, and just think, they asserted, they acted on this belief that women are morally superior to men. It was part of the argument for the women's vote, for women's suffrage, is that women are naturally more moral than men. So if women have the vote, then politics will get cleaned up. Right? Right? We also hear this kind of variation. Women are more important than men because women are better than men in some of the more radical feminists who say something sort of similar to women are morally superior or are more spiritual than men or are more peaceful than men. It also has some origins in the Romantic movement so that there's an elevation of nature women associated with nature. So if nature is good and women are associated with nature, then women are good. It's the mirror of a certain non-feminist view, which diminishes nature, associates women with nature, and then women are bad. Okay, so that's one variation. Women are no less important than men because women are better than men. What I think is the most common articulation of feminism in the United States, and probably in Britain as well, comes out of the Anglo-American rights, civil and social rights view. And that's women are no less important than men because they are equal. Equality, right? Sameness in large degree. That was the one of the basic undergirdings for the efforts to get an equal rights amendment. Right? That women and men both have the same rights to an education, to good housing, to an income, to, you know, whatever it is that we have a right to. And I think that's the one that we hear most often in the United States. There is another way that you could say that men and women are, and that's based on the notion that they're equally good, right? And it is an expansion of our political documents. But another way we might go at this is women and men are equal because they are equally bad. Okay? Equally standing in need of God's grace. Okay? It's a real different starting point. And it reflects something about our view of humanity in general. Those of you who were here and heard Peter Nash talking in Bible study this morning, he had you read this account from 1 Samuel about some people, and when it was over, when they were done reading, he said, "Now, what does this tell you? What do you see here?" And they said, "Well, these are human beings." And he said, "Yeah, they're just as nasty as us, aren't they?" So where you begin, I guess what I'm trying to say here about feminism is we can make this expansive definition, but within it there is variety, and where you start is important. Where you start influences what you see as the problem that needs to be fixed, and also the options that you will consider for fixing it, right? If you think the problem that needs to be solved is primarily a social problem, you might think it can be solved by legislation and education, right? If you think women are just morally superior to men, you may think the only solution is separatism. Right? If you think something else, you get a different, you know, the trajectory is different. The other thing I want to say, two other things about feminism. First of all, although the term is recent, the ideas are not. Okay. The ideas that are articulated by what we call in the U.S. the second wave of American feminism, to distinguish it from the 19th century, are not new ideas. You can find them again and again in history being articulated. The second is to always remind ourselves that ideas are not free-floating. Ideas are always attached to people. Okay, so we can talk about feminism, but that the ideas are always attached to persons who have gotten those ideas from somewhere and who act on them. And that's partly why, one of the reasons I wanted to put some people up there. So we don't just have feminism as some of my 18 and 19-year-old students seem to think it's some boogeyman kind of monster thing that's lurking in the closet, some kind of slime that might spread out and grab them. It's not. It's something that's attached to people. Yeah.
My mind is racing. I'm afraid I'm going to forget it. I'll say it right now.
Quick.
You talked about the argument of the equal rights amendment.
Right.
The counter argument was, we've already got that. It's in the Constitution. And in Oregon recently, they had the fight, should there be special rights for people who are homosexual?
Right.
And the argument is, no special rights, we've all got the same. The status quo people say, mankind is sufficient. You don't have to make further distinctions. You've said it. And they say, oh no, when you say it that way. So the argument, I think, is between whether or not we have to make distinctions.
Well, that's one of the arguments. I think with the Equal Rights Amendment, there's this another issue which has to do with recognition of, on the one hand, equality, and on the other hand, difference.
Yeah.
And that equality and difference are not mutually exclusive terms. Okay. And that, I'm going to say something later about how the relationship between these two is continually evolving. I think also it's important to recognize about feminism that although the ideas are not new, they are constantly being refined. And one of the places that I see this, because my sphere of activity is largely in the academy, in education, and in the church, is that 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, there was much assertion that women had an equal ability to do certain jobs. And having achieved the opportunity to do those jobs, what we're now often saying is we have an equal ability to do them. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to do it exactly the same way. Right? And I think some men in particular feel like the terms have been switched. You know, you said you were going to do it, you could do it equally well. I thought you were going to do it the same way. And now you're doing it different. And is that fair? You know, and it's a big issue in education, because then when we do evaluation, do you apply the same standards to discover if you're doing it equally well, if you're doing it a different way? So there's that as well as the thing about, do we need to name every category? Are we more likely to be inclusive with a list that specifies or with a general category? You know, and there we're working both with ideals and reality. Okay,
question.
So, yeah.
Oh, okay.
You and then.
Are you suggesting then that, speaking of evaluation, that it is not the measured outcome, but rather the process that is being evaluated then?
I'm not sure that you can distinguish those. And I guess what I'm saying is that in my experience, sometimes the tools that have been devised for evaluation don't take into account that different things are going on, or that students have different expectations of women. And so if one of my colleagues would teach in a very similar way to me, he would be evaluated positively as very firm and clear, and I would be evaluated negatively as pushy. Okay? That's what I'm referring to. Yeah.
I got a little bit of a problem with your definition. When you say that feminism means that women are no less important than men, I think you have to look at important to whom. Is it important to the women? Important to men?
Yeah.
Important to the U.S. government?
Exactly. You're right. And that's
a woman can be in a marriage and be subjugated to her husband and be considered important in terms of he can't get along without doing the kind of work she's doing,
right.
but be nowhere near equal.
Right. And that's precisely one of the variations then in these clusters. Because in my expansive definition, I want to leave room for this group that's sometimes called domestic feminists, who instead of wanting the same job, people like Catherine Beecher in the 19th century, who said that what was needed was for women's work to be valued more highly. Okay, now that's not necessary. I mean, that view and this other view of equality being sameness and the same equal rights they're real different, but they have this one little point of overlap, which is that women are no less important than men. And so what I have given you there is the least common denominator. And you're right that there are those variations. Yeah. Well, then let's go on and let me say perhaps something briefer about what Christianity is. We all know that the range of things that go by the name Christianity is equally immense, perhaps even more immense. There's historical variety as this has developed over 2,000 years. There is ideological variety that we can see very plainly in our own talents and our own experiences. So here I'll just give a kind of broad stroke definition that and to do what someone was suggesting before, to move from Christianity as a religion to an institutional definition, that the Christian church is made up of those people and groups of people who claim Jesus as the one sent by God to redeem the world. I've given that definition partly because it follows the problem-solution model. Okay, that there is a problem, and that Christians identify a particular problem, and in the theological shorthand, we usually call that sin, and that the solution to that problem of sin is somehow lodged with this person, Jesus the Christ. And I would think that's pretty central to Christians, although there's some debate around the edges. Again, people hold these views. There is Christianity, a religion. There is the church, an institution. But it is Christians, people, who hold these views. Now, what possible relationships can there be between these two sets of ideas held by people? Well, I have a little three-part suggestion, all starting with A's. We can look at them as apathetic, adversarial, or, unfortunately, my grammatically they don't all parallel, as having affinity and adjustment potential. The things that you listed when I wasn't prompting you to get nasty all pretty much go to this affinity and adjustment category, which suggests to me that we're pretty much of the same mind here. But I think it's important to recognize that both of these two possible relationships are strongly advocated by some people. So let me speak about each of those first of all. Apathetic. There are Christians, as hard it is for me to imagine, who seem to have no idea what feminism is, that it exists, and that it should matter to them. My father-in-law is a pastor in a small parish in Indiana. They still use the service book and hymnal. They've had them rebound. And they don't mess with the language at all. So when I receive absolution there, I wish power to become a son of God. You know, and I go, because I can't believe that no one has, and I suppose people in that congregation think, well, why doesn't his daughter-in-law say something to him, you know? There are lots of people who are faithful Christians who just don't see feminism. They don't see the assertions it makes. They don't see the problems it addresses. And so they're apathetic. Sometimes out of ignorance, although one wonders how you could miss it. On the other hand, there are a lot of feminists who are apathetic about Christianity for a variety of reasons. And it may, and I don't think that should surprise us in a secularized age. The most recent Newsweek has a lovely little piece in there about the mainstream, the Seven Sisters denominations, and their loss of power. That's what secularization means, of course, is that you take something out of the authority of the church. Initially, it was a very concrete term. That you secularize a convent, for example, meant that it no longer belonged to the church. And Henry VIII took that property and gave it to some noble family instead of to the church. Well, that's happened a lot in our society, and I can see that some feminists might just think, why bother about Christianity? It's a dying thing. Why beat a dead horse? Right? So there is that sort of sense of apathy, one to the other. In the 19th century, there were some feminists who thought it was important to address the Bible. And others said, oh, don't bother. Don't waste your energy. You're never going to convince those people. And that leads us, I think, to the adversarial relationship. Again, it comes from both sides. There are Christians who think that feminism is best understood as, you know, some of these nasty terms we've gotten here, a group of crazy women whose goal is to destroy Christianity. Right? And there are some feminists who say, quite frankly, if you fix Christianity and make it non-patriarchal, there won't be anything left. Right? And so some of them move away, so they look apathetic, but underneath that apathy is an adversarial view that these two things are at such counter purposes that they cannot coexist. Both of those views exist. The third option that I've suggested here is that there is affinity between the two and that they can be mutually adjusting. That each has something to learn from the other. And indeed, the way I set this up, feminist Christianity suggests something about the relationship. I've made Christianity the noun and feminism the adjective. Usually you hear the phrase feminist theology in the same way. But others would do it the reverse, to talk about Christian feminism, with feminism being the noun and Christian being the adjective. That says something, I think, about where the limits are, where the generative power is, where the growing edges are, but I don't want to push that too far. I don't want to say that in some kind of brittle way. I just think that it's worth pondering how we put those words together and how we understand them. How we put them together and how we understand them is dependent, at least in part, I would assert, on our personal experience of both things. I once gave a talk to a group of college students which had as the subtitle, "And How Confirmation Class Made Me a Feminist." My experience is probably not typical. Maybe it is. I'd be interested to hear if other people would say this. But it is at least one way that this personal experience can work. I went to confirmation class. I was a star confirmation student. I grew up to be a church historian, so that shouldn't be a surprise, right? I asked sort of impudent questions that drove the pastor mad. What if you're out in the middle of the desert and you only have orange juice? Can you baptize with orange juice? Would it work? This poor guy who would just look at me like, "You're from a nice family." But I did listen. And one of the things that I learned very deeply in confirmation class, and I think probably before, is that God's grace is available to all people without reference to any of their personal characteristics. Okay? So it was equally available to me as a sort of impudent, smart aleck girl as it was available to the boys who sat in the back row and made spit wads. Right? It wasn't dependent on how smart you were, or how interested you were, or what shape you were, or what family you were from, or what color you were, or, you know, any list of characteristics you could put in there. Because I learned God's grace is a free gift, not earned. Well, I looked around and I discovered that most people don't see things that way. Not only do they not see things that way, they don't act that way. Right? And I think that's why when I began to hear people, feminists, talking about equality and justice and empowerment and struggle, I heard it and it resonated. But it also is why my feminism begins with men and women are equally in need of God's grace. That I start with equality that's based in badness rather than goodness. So that the possible relationships then are many, 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 many. And I'd like to hear some of your ideas, you know, about how those go together. When you, how many of you would apply both of these terms to yourself? Feminism and Christianity. Feminist and Christian. Yeah. Well, how do those go together? Anybody willing to talk about that?
You know, I mean, it's not so much how they go together, but one thing that I feel like we have to address. I mean, it's sort of the rhythm of our liturgy too in church. We have to begin with confession before we get to absolution. Mm-hmm. And my own feeling is that we can't too quickly skip over how much. Patriarchy, or whatever you want to call it, has its roots in biblical sources, mm-hmm. and how deep that goes in people. And then, in fact, a lot of our ideas about what is normative, what, you know, the way things are and are created to be, are deeply rooted in the Bible, mm-hmm. and in terms of the men being on top and the women being on the bottom. And so I think, you know, we have to start with, if we don't start with that, we too quickly can get to, yeah, it's great, you know, the gospel frees and liberates, and, you know, it's perfectly compatible with feminism, which I deeply feel, or else I couldn't, you know, do what I do. But I think, you know, we really have to struggle with how much the gospel itself has to critique the Bible. Mm-hmm. In a way that we still affirm Scripture, you know. I think of Lutherans, so, you know, those of us who are Lutherans, and put a, you know, Scripture's our norm. You know, we have, that's a real struggle. We have to say, how do we do that? How do we both? And I was lucky enough at one point to have my whole Old Testament course from a woman named Phyllis Tribble, who is a feminist biblical scholar. With deep respect for the Bible, and she comes out of a sort of Southern, I don't know if it's Baptist, but it's not like definitely left wing of Protestantism. But how you can, you know, how you can put that together, I guess. So I think we have to do a lot of work on that.
So that if I can echo back, one of the things that weighs that there is this affirmation, but also adjustment, is that feminism can say, yeah, the Bible is important. The Bible is important. The gospel is about freedom. But if the gospel is about freedom, then we need to be real diligent and disciplined and careful about how we read the Bible. Because it's not all healthy. It doesn't all give life. And we need to confess that. So that feminism then becomes a sort of prophetic voice into Christianity, saying sort of, physician, heal thyself, right? And reminds us, if we're Lutheran, of our tradition that you confess and then you're forgiven, that there is sin, and some of the sin is the church's sin. Some of the sin is that we have not used all the gifts that we have been given. And some of those gifts have been in women's bodies. Right?
Yeah. I think the other way that, I don't disagree with any of that, but I think that the other way I think it's possible to have these two things in common is to, not in the romantic sense, but to get back to Jesus. And I think that if we're going to have any adjustments here, most of the adjustments are going to have to occur on the side of Christianity. That we've got to start stripping away the other baggage that we've had down through the centuries associated with the Christian message, and get back to Jesus. And most of the patriarchy, And most of the other stuff that's come on that's been oppressive to women, it has had nothing to do with what Jesus said. Most of the stuff that has to do with men and women's relationships, that Christianity has espoused over the centuries has been either Old Testament based or Paul based. The way we deal with the homosexual issue, we aren't listening to what Jesus said. And I don't think there's either of those. That's where the common ground has to be in my mind.
Others?
Well, I'd like to tell you something about the power which women haven't had for a long time. We're from Washington, and we're from the Shoreline School District, where there was a woman who got quite a bit of anyhow, she's as the woman, the mom in tennis shoes.
Oh, yes.
She went on to become Patty Murray. Okay. Well, she came back and talked to us, and she gave us just one example, which I think sums the whole thing up of what's wrong with this country. She and Barbara Booker from California were both on the Ways and Means Committee. She was the woman that kept ordering the house, I don't know what to call it, but Barbara Booker was the chairman. So they were conducting this meeting and going along, you know, just real fine. And Strom Thurmond wandered in and started talking about something, had nothing to do with what they were doing. And she said, "Senator, you're out of order." Mm-hmm. And he looked at her, and he looked at the chairman, and Barbara Booker said, "Yes, Senator, you're out of order." And he stomped out and said, "Well, things certainly have changed around here." And I think, you know, this has gone on long enough. It's about time that somebody got in there that didn't just understand what was going on and had the courage to stand up. Because they don't care whether they get reelected or not. They are there to do a job.
I'd like to affirm what you were saying. But recently, I wanted to distinguish between Christianity and Christendom. Christendom being the whole long train where we began, and going back before the Judeo-Christian tradition. And what do you expect? We, of course, have grown. I should hope so. Thy kingdom come. We're in the process of becoming. But we're carrying all that baggage. I'm a Catholic. I'm embarrassed by my Pope, who seems to... I'm so glad I came to hold her rather than dead. who seems to fail to make the distinction between Christianity and Christendom. He sees himself as the protector of Christendom. As the old black song was, old time religion. That's the way Paul and Silas did it. This is the way, you know. And today, for you to talk about a book, paper never refused ink. Here's a book that says, "I aspire to be a son of, what is it, a
son of God?
Well, I might as well aspire to be a male lesbian." There's something inherently, it doesn't fit. I want very much to come down on the side of Christianity being the noun and feminist being the adjective. Otherwise, I can see where we're just going to split and split and split and split and split forever. Everybody's got a cause. But if we saw Christianity in its purging condition and its self-purging, you know, it's just because Grandpa did it this way, just because Strom Thurmond was cock of the roost for so many years, things are over. Hallelujah.
The starting point that you make in terms of male and female being in equal need of God's grace, in my mind, is a good starting point, but it doesn't filter out to equality, mm-hmm. in my mind. It comes to oneness. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a distinction. Equality is a, in my mind, is a democratic principle that can go a long way to the secularization of the church. Mm-hmm. And the oneness that Paul talks about in Christ seems to me is a restoration of a created relationship. Luther's commentary on, for example, on Genesis says that, you know, prior to that problem of sin, there is absolutely no difference, distinction, noticeable in any way on any level between male and female. Luther's comment. So in that third chapter of Genesis, in the curse formula, well, the woman will be subject to her husband. So that the problem within creation and the distortion of the relationship is a problem of sin. And it seems to me that the restoration is an announcement of grace and forgiveness and not a battle line on the level of democratic ideal. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it seems that a lot of that filters out into the church, that the battles are drawn on the question of equality, not on an understanding of the announcement of oneness mm-hmm. that we have with one another.
Or of wholeness.
Or what?
Wholeness.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's a very difficult perspective because equality basically is trying to do a battle in Congress, so right. to speak.
Well, and if you let me just comment before we go to you, I see your hand up. I don't want to miss you. I think that you point out some really important things about the arenas in which the conversation takes place. And the arena is important. Equality is a political term often, as it's used in this debate. And it has to do with, for example, things like how much funding do you give to girls' sports and boys' sports in junior high, right? And that's not the whole answer, right? There are other things that are going on. And some of them have to do with family relationships, intimate family relationships. Some have to do with workplace relationships. Some have to do with what happens in liturgy. And equality as simply one-to-one correspondence, I think you're right. It takes us part of the way, but not all the way. It doesn't get us home, but it gets us further along the way. And oneness, wholeness, I think it's really helpful to begin to think, what is the goal that we have? First here, and then I should know your name. Anne, yeah.
This is kind of a real different relationship, but for personally, emotionally, the more, and I'm pretty new in feminist thing, but the more I learn about history and about the rest of the world, the more scary the battle is. and I guess one relationship for me is the relationship of God's strength and grace and justice in keeping, being hopeful about the future. Because, if you look at other cultures in our world, we think we're disenfranchised. And I mean, and you look at history and what's happened. And so for me personally, one of the relationships is, and again, it's Christianity, not Christendom, is the message of justice and all that gives me some hope about feminism. I think if you just go to look at what has been the history of women's lives, you can get very, very discouraged. Mm-hmm. So for me, sometimes the Christian message is the message of hope, that of the grace that you were talking about.
Yeah, thanks, Anne. Someone in the back.
Going back to your original question of how we put Christianity and feminism together, this is something that I struggle with a lot and work with a lot. I am also a Catholic, and even worse than that, I am a convert to the Catholic Church. And being a feminist, many people have said, we thought you were thinking. We thought you were a thinking person. How could you possibly be a thinking person and be a Catholic? How can you be a feminist and be a Christian? How can you put all those things together? And actually, I think the fact that I am now Catholic is a sign of God's great sense of humor, because it really wasn't my idea. I find that what I'm doing, I am a psychologist, and I'm also a teacher and a Jesuit university. And so I work with a lot of primarily Catholic women, lay women as well as religious. And also I work with a fair number of priests and other Catholics too. So I talk a lot about this. And what I go back to is what this gentleman was talking about over here. I go back to Jesus as the foundation of the connection between the two. And I look at Jesus as the one who shows us the face of God that is turned toward humanity. And so what I see in Jesus' face, not only in what he said, but primarily, even more strongly, in how he behaved toward people, I see the incredible value and dignity of all people, men or women, and that he received people exactly the way they were, and he didn't require a litany of justification. He didn't say, who are you, and what's your family background, and all those things, and are you from a nice family, etc. He took people exactly where they were. So what I end up talking about most of all, in all the classes that I teach, everything that I do, I eventually get around to talking about grace, because I think that is the connection between the two. And I find, particularly within the Catholic Church, that is something that is hardly understood at all. Very, very little attention given to it. And the Catholic women, particularly, are absolutely thirsty for it. They suck it up, and it is incredibly healing.
I would like to point to some things that have been happening in the field. Not to say that I don't want to hear any more from you ever, but that I'd like to hear from you at coffee break and you know, and other places. One of the wonderful things about Holden is the conversations that began in sessions don't end when you go out the door, but that this is the place where we began. And I'd like to just kind of give you some ideas about other things that other people are saying and some suggestions of places you might look. So far, I think that the adjustments have been, as you have suggested, primarily that Christianity has been learning from feminism about itself. By and large, it hasn't been finding out new things in the sense of novel, but new in the sense of having been forgotten. You know, the wonderful parable in the book of Luke about the woman with the lost coin, that feminists in the church have been very busy sweeping in the corners to find those lost coins. And then we give a party. Remember that. Then we give a party and invite everyone. So that hopefully, I hope, that what happens in feminist Christianity is not that people get morose and guilty and sad, but rather that we get excited and joyous. As you're saying, people are thirsty. I do think there are some things that Christians and Christianity can offer to feminism. And I'll say something about that later. What has happened in general? There's been new information. We have learned new things. And as a historian, of course, I always cringe when people start going, well, Christendom, the whole history of the church, let's be careful. Because without the history of the church, we wouldn't know about Jesus, right? We may have added some stuff on, and we may have distorted some things, but without the church, we wouldn't know about Jesus. It's the church, the institution, that has passed this on. And while there is maybe the main stream that has been oppressive to women, there has always been countervailing movement. And as we ask questions about women, we learn wonderful things, not only about specific women, but about Christianity. For example, Carolyn Bynum, a medieval historian who's just splendid, has studied the imagery of food in the lives of some ascetic women in the Middle Ages. And she has made wonderful insights about the way we eat and the way we understand the Eucharist and the way we do charity are interconnected. Eating, feeding, and feasting. You know, those three things. She also has found different patterns of religious development when she's looked at female saints, then the sort of conversion, turn around, go a different way. She's found that many of those women seem to have a much more continuous development. And some of us have had that. I'm not saying that it's the only way, but if you grow up in a tradition like Catholics and Lutherans, where you start with infant baptism and education and nurture, you know, there is a sort of continuity rather than dramatic change. And I think it's important that we lift that up and say, yeah, that's a way God works too. So we've gotten new information, some of it about women. and some of it about women and applicable more widely. We have gotten new questions, for example, about the role of experience in theology. What does it matter who you are? Well, it turns out it matters quite a bit. One of my teachers tells about going to Germany, and he went to visit the household of some 19th century biblical scholar whose name I always forget. But he tells about how when you go through this little tour, they tell you that this man was so nice. He was such a considerate man that when he got up early in the morning, instead of writing, he would read because he didn't want to wake up the servant to light the fire to thaw out his ink. Right? Now, what does this tell you about 19th century German theologians? It tells you that they were pretty well off. And yeah, he was considerate of his servant, but he had a servant. He wasn't a servant. And doesn't that give you different questions? Doesn't it cast freedom in a different way? One of the places this comes out particularly clearly, I think, has to do with one of the principal ethical moral issues of our day, one that threatens to split churches and countries apart, namely abortion. Most moral theologians, most ethicists in the history of the church have been men. We have a carefully nuanced, wonderfully complex set of teachings about war. Right? Don't we? The just war theory, and when is it okay to do it, and when is it not okay to kill someone, and is it okay to do it this way or that way? Or it's really nuanced. Well, of course we would, because that's something that the people who have been doing the thinking have been involved with. They haven't been really involved with abortion, right? And they haven't had to think about it. Now, I think maybe some feminists could learn something from Christianity about how to think about abortion. I don't have the answer. But I know what some of the questions are. And some of the questions, I don't think, have taken enough account of relationship, of all the people who are affected by that decision. I don't know the answer. I'm not going to say that I know the answer. I'm just saying that Christianity could maybe help us understand, once we get past the legal questions, to the moral questions that we each face. Other things that have come to Christianity from feminism are, of course, how we speak about God. And here I don't mean simply do we say he or she, but also things like Sally McFaig's work on thinking of God, Jesus, as our friend, and the power of that image, to think of Jesus as your friend, and also what it does for your understanding of friendship if Jesus is your friend. The ongoing meaning of the Trinity. This is a point about which there is much acrimonious debate right now. What does the Trinity mean? I think it has something to do with relationship. The relationship between the persons of the Trinity. I don't know that this question would have come up if women hadn't started asking about the masculinity of God. And what is the theological significance of the masculinity of God? We have gotten wonderful leaders. You mentioned Phyllis Trible. I could go through a huge, long list. There are some books in the bookstore that if you're interested in these topics, you might want to look at. I saw this morning out on the sale table one copy of With Passion and Compassion, which is a collection of essays by women from Asia, Latin America, and Africa. It's wonderful. It's some of the most exciting religious writing I have read in my life. I know we have in the bookstore I think it's the 10th anniversary edition of Rosemary Radford Ruther's Sexism and God Talk. Rosemary Ruther, if you don't know her name, she is like the mother of us all when you talk about feminist theology. And it's a very accessible effort to understand how feminism and Christianity reinforce one another, how feminism can be a prophetic voice within Christianity. We have several volumes in the bookstore by Dorothy Zola, a German Lutheran theologian, and I think her work is just splendid. We have also over there the Women's Bible Commentary. So, you know, some of you pointed to the need to take the Bible seriously. This is a wonderful resource, book by book, pointing out the usual historical and textual things about the the passages, but also raising questions specifically out of feminism. And then there's lots of other stuff to read. I've been reading this summer Dakota, which some of you, especially from the Midwest, may know, by Kathleen North. It's not explicitly feminist, but it has these themes. There's so much out there, and I guess what I say to you, so many of you raise your hand, yes, I'm both, is to say you're not alone. You're in good company. Read, talk, and let's move along in this struggle along this road. And I think we're just right on the money here, on the time. Keep talking to each other. I'm around all week, and I'd love to continue this with you more. Later in the week, I'm going to do a session, a kind of historical session about American religious women with slides. So. And this session is about Lutherans, in which the feminism isn't as explicit, but it's there. Thank you very much. You've been great.